I'm Polly Warren and welcome to the Positive Perimenopause Podcast. This is the place for some positive inspiration to help you through the rollercoaster ride of perimenopause. I truly believe that with the right support, knowledge and wellness tools, you can feel your best yet. Because I'm learning this life phase can be a truly exciting and often pivotal time of life. With every episode, my mission is to support and empower you to own your menopause, because it's time to start taking care of the most important person, and yes, that's you. So thank you for being here and sharing your time with me. Now let's dive in. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. How are you doing? I hope you've had a good week. I had a wonderful weekend visiting lots of friends, celebrating birthdays. It was great. But then unfortunately on Sunday, I was hit with allergy and I've been in bed for a couple of days, which is really unlike me. I very rarely get on well. I'm not very good at it. I did initially think, oh my God, I've just got a bit of a hangover, but it was more than that. It was more than that. Anyway, I'm feeling so much more human now. And do you know what? It was good. I listened to my body. I did really rest up and hopefully I've seen the back of that horrible allergy. Okay, on to this week. Well, firstly, let me just tell you a little bit about last week's episode, which was just me. It was a solo episode talking all about finding your purpose. I think so many of us can get to perimenopause, get to midlife, and really start to question, you know, is this it? Is this everything I'm here to do? And this is relatively normal. So we really delve into that and we talk about the benefits of having a purpose, finding your purpose, if that's you and you haven't feel like there is more for you and you haven't discovered what you're here to do yet. So come on over, have a little look, listen to that. And then on to this week's episode, which is with Dr. Louise Oliver. Now, Dr. Louise Oliver is a GP. She's also a functional breathing practitioner and therapeutic life coach. Dr. Louise has had a special interest in women's health and menopause for many years, and she now incorporates her skills as a functional breathing practitioner to raise awareness of how breathing is altered by hormones. Yep, it's another thing which is affected by our hormones. And she ultimately, really what she wants to do is to help women thrive during perimenopause and beyond. Dr. Louise believes that breathing is an essential part of the perimenopausal jigsaw puzzle, but it's often a piece that is overlooked or not addressed, even though hormones affect our breathing efficiency. So if you're someone who wakes up in the morning feeling exhausted despite sleeping pretty well, then this episode is an absolute must listen for you. But really, everyone needs to be aware of how they breathe, because it's something that affects every aspect of our lives. And the more efficient and the more effective we are in our breathing, the better it's going to make us feel. So without further ado, please welcome the brilliant Dr. Louise Oliver. So I'm very excited today to be talking to Dr. Louise Oliver all about, oh, well, so many things, but primarily about breathing. So hello, Louise. Really nice to have you on the podcast. Thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really excited to talk about it too.
Yeah, well, I thought a good place to start actually would be to talk about your personal approach towards helping women thrive as they transition through perimenopause, because it's an approach I very much subscribe to myself. And I really love the way you talked about it, in that you see menopause and perimenopause as a kind of a whole jigsaw puzzle to be looked at, and that there are very many different pieces to that jigsaw puzzle, which we need to really look at each one in order to have a really positive experience. So perhaps you could just sort of talk me through that, and then we can maybe then go on to look at breathing in more depth.
Well, I've been a GP for over 20 years now, and I was very lucky at the beginning of my training. I managed to do some extra training in women's health and have provided contraception, sort of coils and implants right through that. So I've sort of just been a passive observer of people at different points in their reproductive life. And I do genuinely think that people can thrive as they go through the perimenopause and menopause. Yes, there are challenges, and yes, some people will find it more tricky than others. But I do think it's a time where we've got to look, step back a little bit, and instead of I think women sometimes there's this approach that we just got to keep pushing. We've got to push, always pushing forward. And actually sometimes we've got to step back and actually look at the bigger picture. And I definitely see it as a jigsaw puzzle, basically, and there's different bits to that. So obviously hormones is one bit of that. Cardiovascular exercise, more calming activities, resistance training, connection to others, spirituality, cold exposure. There's all sorts of things that are there. And breathing actually is one of those pieces that I don't think people recognize. And I think it can feel overwhelming when you're going through that time phase. But I think stepping back and just seeing which are the pieces that you've got the most to gain from, and just picking one or two of those and just making it doesn't have to be perfect. Don't think you've got to optimize a piece until it's absolute perfection. No, just optimize it until it's sort of you've got some benefit from it, and then move on to the next piece. And it might be you're ignoring one piece. One of my pieces has been resistance training, and I've been ignoring it, and I'm now actually dipping my toe in the water. But you've got to be gentle with yourself as well. I think, be kind to yourself. You might not want to address that piece, but that's okay. But just be tiny step forward. And all these pieces, once you start to sort of make them a little bit better, I think it really helps people move forward, definitely.
Yeah, I totally agree. I see that all the time as well in the work that I do. I'll have someone who will come to me and maybe their real focus is on nutrition, and that is something which we really work on. And we kind of but until we've kind of got that piece to a certain level, then it's very difficult to actually even think about moving your body or going and doing some resistance training. You need that sort of energy to move you on to do the next bit. For some others, it might be that they're doing all the nutrition, they're doing all the exercise, but actually they're incredibly stressed. So we kind of have to look at sort of how can we manage that stress, because that impacts everything else as well. And more recently, I seem to be attracting a lot of people all about finding their purpose. They're feeling really unfulfilled at this stage of life, and that is another really important piece. So yeah, I love what you're saying. It's all of these parts of us are so crucial to have a really positive experience, but it's virtually impossible to do all of them at the same time. You've got to take bits as they come. I would love to talk more about this breathing part of the jigsaw, because I found you because I listened to a podcast you did with Dr. Louise Newsom, and I just found it really fascinating, because I think there's a real lack of awareness about how breathing is affected as we transition through perimenopause. So maybe the first place, a good place to start would be, how did you get into breathing? Why did you decide to pursue sort of becoming a functional breathing practitioner? So yes, tell me all.
Oh gosh. Sometimes some things in life just happen when you do something spur of the moment, and there was no plan. I'm quite a perfectionist probably, and I like to plan things, and this was so not planned. Being honest, as a doctor, you do an NHS appraisal each year, and you have to choose around sort of one topic. You have to choose some learning, basically, to do 50 hours of learning for that year. And normally I'm quite methodical of what I want to learn about. And my appraiser says, so what are you going to study then the next year? And I had this moment of, oh God, I hadn't put any thought process into it. And there's certain topics I didn't want to talk about or learn about. And I just said mindfulness. And it was just a real spur of the moment thing. I said, I don't know anything about it. I've tried to promote it. The patients see right through me because I know nothing about it. If it's meant to be good, shall I do that? And she, oh, that's a great idea. Brilliant. And then lo and behold, a week later, just randomly got an email saying there's a mindfulness course on for GPs, went to that. And I was just fascinated by the science of it. She really included the science behind it. And I really connected and thought, she suggested a book. So I read the book, and I just went down this sort of meandering path with no fixed outcome. And then ended up, my husband said, oh, I think you'd be quite good as a sort of life coach. And he'd seen an article of a doctor who's also a life coach. And okay, did my life coach certificate, and as part of that she included the autonomic nervous system and breathing, and it really fascinated me. And then I read James Nestor's book, and I went down a big pathway. But I had a profound moment with a patient in a coil fitting, and she has given me permission to talk in an anonymous way about that, but it was profound. And I don't know if you want me to talk about that, but
yes, I'd love to hear it. Yeah, definitely.
And that changed my career, and I just was like, right, I've got to, this is something that's so important. So this lady had a very traumatic birth, and said, you have to put coil in me. I cannot get pregnant. I need to know that I've got a really reliable method of contraception. So generally nobody's happy to come and have a coil. They always have a look of fear as I bring them from the waiting room. But this lady was literally shaking, you know, she was in complete fight flight mode. And it was quite clear I was not physically going to be able to fit that coil, but she was desperate. You have to fit this thing. I cannot get pregnant again. And obviously I didn't want to say no, but I thought, I just won't be able to physically do this. And I thought, what can I tap into? And so I just said, can I just get you to breathe in a certain way just for 5 minutes, and we'll just see what happens. And if I'm honest, I sat down at the computer and started doing some emails. I thought, I'll just give her 5 minutes quietly, thinking then I'm going to have to say she's going to have to leave. And she just melted into the couch. She just, all her shaking stopped, and she just became serene. And I fitted the coil gently, quietly. And I had to say then, I finished. And she was like, oh my goodness me. And literally what happened was we transported that patient from a complete fight flight response, because she associated being examined with trauma, with pain and trauma. Yeah. And she just breathed in a way that essentially was like giving her like a tranquilizer.
Yeah.
And the three of us in the room, myself, my assistant and the patient, were like, what on earth just happened there? And it was that moment where I was like, right, I want to learn more about this. And I taught myself initially, but improved my breathing, and then thought, right, I want to be a practitioner. So you can, that was a dramatic way of it, but you can alter your autonomic nervous system with your breathing, and that is the most powerful thing, and people don't realize that. And that is what I really promote, that I want people to realize they've got that influence on themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's so powerful, isn't it? Because it's something we all do. We all have our breath, and it is obviously one of the, it is the most important function of our bodies. Without it, we're dead. And it is something that we have control of. We have full control of, but yet it's something which so many of us don't think about or realize, we take for granted. I mean, whereas you were telling that story, it really brought up memories of childbirth, which I've done 3 times. But again, you know, I used my breath so much in that process, and it got me through it, without a doubt. It got me through each of my births. And in many other areas of my life, I've definitely used my breath, you know, just going to the dentist or, you know, all these sorts of things just to calm myself down. So I think some of us do it, maybe not even really realizing that we're using it or doing it, but it is something that we can learn to control even more, and awareness of it is absolutely everything. So I'd love to know, Louise, first of all, what is effective breathing? How do we know that we're breathing correctly and efficiently and effectively?
I mean, I think, first of all, it's people just being aware that you assume that because we breathe and generally it's unconscious, you assume it's efficient. And actually, that's the first thing to realise, like, is my breathing efficient? That's the question you want to ask yourself. And don't do it retrospectively. I have so many people who tell me they breathe wonderfully, and then actually when I say, well, gently, could you just have a little look going forward over the next week? So don't write it off. Actually, prospectively, just monitor your breathing over the next week. And the time to look at it is when you're distracted. So it's when you're on your phone, when you're on the computer, when you're watching the TV, at work, you know, first of all, what's happening to your mouth? Is it open? Is it closed? So essentially effective breathing is nasal breathing. So that's breathing in and out of the nose. So that's the first thing. And you, if comfortable, they could ask loved ones or people they live with, you know, could you just keep an eye on me for the next week and just make some, you know, just observe my breathing. So it should be in and out of the nose. It should at rest. It should be quiet, soft, slow and gentle. And actually the exhale is longer than the inhale. And there's a little pause when you get really good at breathing. There's a little tiny pause after the exhale before you breathe in. And I don't like talking about belly breathing because women can move their bellies when they breathe and not actually move their diaphragm. We have a great ability to do that. If you are using your diaphragm to breathe, when you breathe in, the lower ribs go out and the lower ribs go in when you exhale. So that would be the simplest way to look at it. There is an assessment that there's a bunch of scientists that looked at how we can assess whether people are breathing efficiently. It's really, there's different ways of breathing inefficiently. So it's really difficult to get a consistent assessment for it. And I think this is what makes it difficult to study it, because if you can't actually, if you're struggling to sort of diagnose it, if you like, then how can you show an improvement?
Yeah.
So it makes it difficult from a research point of view. But if people are interested, on my website, because we might not have time to talk about it now, I've got a video with me, and on it, probably midway through, there's four questions and we do a comfortable breath hold time. And I describe that there. But I just say check in with your breathing and see. And if it's not as we described, then you may not be breathing efficiently. And remember, look at your breathing when you're awake. Try and consider it when you're asleep, because again, it should be like that, in and out of the nose, quiet and gentle and slow. And actually when you're exercising as well.
Yeah, exercising is an interesting one. Actually, I was thinking about this morning as I was exercising, and it's quite tricky to breathe in and out of your nose when you're exercising. I was really trying to consciously do it, but actually finding it hard, particularly when you're sort of short of breath. So I don't know if you've got any tips for that. So how do you, I mean, I'm just intrigued. You know, I was really trying, but actually I would have to open my mouth at certain points.
So what's happening there is, that's a really crucial one. So our primary driver to breathe, so the thing that makes our brain send a signal to breathe, is actually carbon dioxide. Okay. So when you're exercising, you're producing more waste product, you're producing more carbon dioxide, and that starts to rise. We've got so much excess oxygen in our lungs, it's untrue. So it's not an oxygen problem. You know, when you breathe in, you actually throw out 75% of the oxygen you breathe in. Okay, that's at rest.
That's a lot, yeah.
Even when you're exercising, you will throw out about 25% of the oxygen that you breathe in. So taking a bigger breath in will not give you more oxygen, because you're already throwing out excess oxygen. So you've got loads of oxygen in your lungs. The issue is about getting oxygen to your blood, to your cells. So when you're exercising, so say I'm trying to go for a run and I'm trying to maintain nasal breathing, at some point I'm going to feel like I'm suffocated and I'm going to have to mouth breathe. And we call that air hunger. And I promise you, it is not your oxygen level dropped. So there's so many people now who've got oxygen saturation probes. So by all means, pop on your finger and watch it, and your oxygen level does not drop. What's happened is your carbon dioxide has risen. And we all have a personalized sensitivity level for they're called chemoreceptors. So we have a personal level that once it hits that level, then it sends that suffocated type signal to you that you have to mouth breathe. But that can be trained.
Okay.
You can be trained to be less sensitive to it. And what the wonderful thing is about carbon dioxide, and I see this all the time, is you get someone who's incredibly sensitive to the buildup of carbon dioxide. So I have some people who, even me telling them to get their mouth closed, and I just want to see them sat there, they can get air hunger with that. So you get it with exercise. So some individuals can have such difficult breathing that I say, right, can you just close your mouth for me now? I've got a saturation probe on them. I just want to see, and you can see them getting uncomfortable. But they're looking at, oh, it's still 98%. Yes. But they're incredibly sensitive to that buildup of it. But then you train them to be less sensitive to it. And then carbon dioxide is actually a wonderful gas. It opens up blood vessels, which helps us think clearer. It makes us be able to do more exercise because we get more oxygen to our tissues. And it's really calming. It's really calming for the nervous system. So you take someone who's petrified of this air hunger, but then you train them to be less sensitive to it. They see that they actually can change their body, which is very powerful for some people who've particularly lost hope that they could ever feel any better. And then they actually feel, oh, I actually like this carbon dioxide. It's making me feel really calm. So it's, and I think they are doing some studies on treating people for panic disorder and anxiety with carbon dioxide. But you don't need a gas canister. You've got your own carbon dioxide. Mm. So,
and with that training, and I mean, we're going to talk about the how, we can maybe a bit later on, but just, you know, that when you talk about training, I'm presuming that is through some breathing techniques and breathing exercises. Okay, which we will come, well, let's talk about that in a bit later. What I'd like to know first, though, is when we're not breathing properly, you know, what happens to us? What do we begin to feel? And then let's bring menopause into this as well, you know, and how does menopause and going through this perimenopause transition, how does that affect our breathing?
Well, essentially, it's not completely clear. I think there's some ideas, but it's difficult. There's not enough research on it. But something about the hormonal changes as we go through perimenopause, menopause and beyond affects the way we breathe. And there is a steep rise in the rate of what we call sleep disordered breathing. And that's a spectrum. So it's anything from at one end, like just noisy breathing, sort of, you know, resistance to the air coming in, and then snoring maybe in the middle, and then sleep apnea, which is this horrible condition where people actually have gaps in their breathing and essentially lower their oxygen levels overnight in their brain and body. So it's a spectrum, and the rates of that massively increase as women go through this transition through to postmenopause. And yes, I know people say, well, that's because maybe people put on weight and maybe a bit thick around the neck. But even when the scientists take that out, irrespective of weight and other confounding factors, there is an increase in it. And we think it's to do with the fact of the changing hormone levels. And we do lose a bit of tone in the back of our throat, which is not surprising. We know we lose tone in other muscles. So why not consider we're losing tone in our breathing muscles and losing tone at the back of our throat? So we should be doing work to improve that strength, and then that will help our breathing. And it's breathing, how we breathe when we're asleep is absolutely crucial to our health. Absolutely crucial.
Yeah. I mean, because we all know that if we have, you know, don't have a good night's sleep, then we're going to feel groggy in the morning. It's going to increase things like brain fog, or, you know, we're going to become more irritable. So what can we start to do in terms of kind of looking at our breathing at night? How do we know that we're not breathing properly? Because actually there are so many reasons that we might be feeling really crappy in the morning. How do we know it's our breathing? What can we do?
Yeah, and obviously some of it may be hormones, mightn't it, that might be improved by HRT or, you know, I still subscribe to all the sleep hygiene, you know, avoid the blue light before bed, you know, all the, everybody knows the sleep hygiene thing. So I still subscribe to all that, but in there should be consider how you breathe at night. So obviously if you have a sleeping partner, ask them, you know, what's my breathing like at night? Ask them that if they get up to the toilet, they have a little sneaky look at their mouth. You know, if someone is mouth breathing at night, you are never going to sleep. I promise you, you will never, ever sleep as well as if you sleep with your mouth completely closed for the entire time. And there's a lot of science behind that, but the mouth should be closed throughout the entire time. You can download an app. I think Vic Veer, one of the ENT surgeons, he's got an app that you can download and it can listen to at night. And that gives you some indication if your breathing's noisy or snoring or apneas. So you could do that if you've not got a sleeping partner. I mean, being honest, if you wake up, as soon as you wake up, just think, right, where's my mouth? And if your mouth is open, and particularly if it's really dry, and the first thing you're doing is going for a drink, probably likely that you've been mouth breathing. Also, if you have a lot of nasal congestion when you wake up, well, it makes it more likely, because you're obviously, if you're blocked in your nose, you're more likely then your body's going to naturally want to breathe through your mouth. If you've got a lot of cough or wheeze in the morning, when we breathe in through our mouth, you're bringing cold, dry air into your lungs, which actually triggers a cough reflex and triggers spasm of the breathing tubes. So if you wake up and you're always coughing and wheezing in the morning, I'd be a little bit suspicious there that you that your mouth's breathing overnight. If your breathing's noisy at night, if you're snoring, if you've got gaps in breathing, then essentially, you know, that needs to be dealt with, because that will be affecting your sleep quality. Your nose is a use it or lose it organ. So if you don't use it, your nose actually blocks up. So this is this horrible circle that if my mouth breathes, your body tries to stop you overbreathing, your nose blocks. And then that forces you to continue mouth breathing.
Right. Yeah.
Break that circle and get your mouth closed. And there's an exercise, a nose unblocking exercise that you can use that helps open up the nose. Then you can break that cycle, definitely.
And isn't it true that the nose has so many incredible functions in terms of cleansing the air which goes into it compared to the mouth? And it really helps with sort of fighting off viruses and all that sort of thing as well, isn't it?
Oh, it's I mean, I have to say, I was, when I first realised, it's a mixed emotions. I felt embarrassed that I didn't know that as a doctor. I felt really sad that I had loads of patients sat in front of me over the years who said, why do I keep getting chest infections? And not once did I say, oh, are you using your natural filter in your nose? Not once did I ask if they were nasal breathing or mouth breathing. But, and I suppose disappointed that that wasn't raised at medical school, that, you know, they never once said, oh, the mouth, you know, the functions of the mouth in breathing is this, because there is no function of the mouth in breathing. It's a whole, it's to be used for sort of eating and talking and swallowing and things. And actually then when I thought, oh gosh, all my running that I do and I'm out and sometimes it's next to roads, I'm literally breathing straight in all the pollutants and particles straight into my lungs. It was a wake up moment for it, I have to say. But the nose, it filters the air, it warms the air, it pressurizes the air, it moistens the air. It makes it really kind to the lungs, and it also produces something called nitric oxide, which, as you say, it sterilizes the incoming air. No, it's not. Obviously, it won't be perfect, but at least if you nasal breathe, you're putting your first line of defense in. And I have to say, if you actually notice the difference when you listen to someone's chest. So if I listen to somebody's chest, and I only realized this when I was putting pieces together, if I listen to the chest and someone's nasal breathing, I can hardly hear the breath sounds. That's why a doctor will say, open your mouth, breathe in and out, because it makes the breath sounds harsh and I can hear them. And then I can work out if there's pathology on the lungs. But you do not, honestly, you do not want to be breathing like that all the time.
Mm.
And actually, sometimes when you're listening to people's chests, it can trigger the cough reflex and they get really embarrassed, because obviously they sort of feel like they're coughing on the doctor. But it is just because they're dragging in that cold, dry air into their lungs. So, so I hope if people were aware of that, that, you know, this is really important.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I'd love to ask you about your own personal experience with this, because I know that you had some experience of, was it sleep apnea?
No.
During your perimenopause experience?
Yeah. So I've been fit since probably second year of med school. And so run 3 times a week, didn't think I had any issue with my breathing at all. And then started, and I'm slim. I suddenly started snoring. And, you know, actually having experience of what it's like to suddenly your sleep quality deteriorate. And then obviously trying to be a professional and use your brain in the day when you've not slept well. You know, you're up and down more, going, you know, waking up, you disturb your partner, your sleeping partner. And then, you know, you're grumpy because you've not slept. Your sleeping partner then potentially is grumpy because they've not slept. And it's just a catalog. And then, you know, you feel like it's affecting you at work. It just is a catalog for disaster. And then I obviously was on this journey anyway. I thought, what on earth's going on? And then, oh, it's my perimenopause. Now, I did go on, I'm on HRT, had loads of benefits from going on HRT for other symptoms. It didn't do anything for me for my snoring. So then obviously I was already on this breathing journey, and then tried to teach myself Buteyko. Didn't do it very, very well, but I had a bit of a go. But it was when I was doing my breathing practitioner training, because obviously then you're doing it properly, you're learning it properly, and I actually followed the advice that obviously I now teach people, and my snoring stopped. And I sleep the best I've ever slept. I sleep quietly. My husband now can get a full night's sleep. And the one amazing thing that I didn't believe this when I was taught this, but if you get your mouth closed, you're more likely to not need to go to the bathroom to pass urine overnight. So one of the symptoms of sleep apnea is actually passing urine frequently. And, you know, snoring's on that spectrum. And I didn't believe it, but unless I've drunk a stupid amount of fluid, if I drink my normal fluid, I don't get up to go to the toilet. And this is something that we regularly talk about in the breathing community, that it does seem to help people. And then obviously your mind's not worrying, because you've not, that helps, because you're not going to the toilet, and you're suddenly thinking about the next day.
Oh, that's so interesting. So I'm someone who probably gets up at least once a night. Right. To have a wee in the, you know, and it's really annoying. I think only occasionally my husband might have said, you were breathing heavily, but I think it's all right. But for those who are listening and going, oh my goodness, this all sounds like perhaps I am not breathing as well as I can at night, what are some of the things that they can start to do to help themselves and improve this?
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of two aspects to it, really. So one is we've got to consider getting the airway open, because the airway actually is quite narrow anyway. So you don't want anything to narrow that. So the first thing is if you've got our mouth open, because the jaw then's hung back, and by definition, if your mouth's open, your tongue is in the bottom of the mouth, the back of the tongue forms part of the airway, so it's too far back in the airway. So you have to practice in the day getting muscle memory to have the tongue in the correct position and get the lips sealed. And, you know, I'd probably say it's going to take 2 to 3 months of your body to make that an unconscious habit. So then it'd be better like that at night. So the tongue should be up on the roof of the mouth, so on the palate of the mouth, sort of flat against the roof of the mouth.
I'm doing it now. I think mine was there anyway, but yeah, good. Okay.
flat against the roof of the mouth. You don't want to have it against the front teeth, because eventually it's a muscle, it'll make them go wonky. So just a little gap there. And then you want to make sure you sealed your lips like you have done. People have a tendency then to clench. So I find it easier if I leave just like a tiny little gap between my teeth. So your face should be nice and relaxed. And you actually get slightly like more definition on your sort of here and under here. So it's actually quite a nice thing for your facial appearance. So just practicing that. And so if people tag that to an everyday activity, so maybe filling up the water bottle, the kettle, when the key goes in the car, going to the toilet, washing your hands, and it just saying in your head, tongue, and you go through the routine in the roof of the mouth, not in front of, not touching the teeth, seal your lips, don't clench, relax face, and then just start to slow your breathing down. You're more efficient with breathing if it's slower. So that's one thing, practicing tongue position and nasal breathing. The other thing is women, we talked about this lack of tone at the back of the throat. Mr. Vic Veer, he's an ENT surgeon who has a snoring and sleep apnea clinic, I think on the NHS and privately. He's done a video on YouTube for exercises to strengthen the back of the throat and the tongue. So if just people put in Vic Veer exercises for sleep apnea and snoring.
In the show notes so people can see. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So basically just do that every day. It's really, really quick. And then obviously if the mouth is open at night, I know no one's keen on it, but you have to use a product to get it shut. And it's the one thing that sometimes it takes an element of trust, but I can honestly say if your mouth is open, you won't sleep as well. So you can practice keeping your mouth closed in the day, and it will help it at night. But if you have that tendency that it's always open, just use a product that gets it shut. And I'd probably say wear it every night for 3 months just to get that sort of your body to realize that that's the new way that you want to breathe. And there's different products. I had to use them. So nothing that I am saying now is everything that I'm saying and promote and teach is what I've done to myself. So you can use micropore. You can put it fully across the mouth. James Nestor puts it just across like this. And Patrick McEwen, who I did my breathing training with, he's designed MyoTape, which actually goes around the mouth. So for those people who perhaps would feel a bit suffocated having something across the lips, and that's really comfortable to use. You just sort of stretch it, stick it round, and then the elastic tension just gently closes it. But you can still talk and take a drink with it. So
yeah.
And then, so that's keeping the airway open. And then the next thing is, a lot of us in modern day society overbreathe. So it's then training your body to breathe with what our body requires. And that's the bit with the carbon dioxide sensitivity. And that's the bit that takes, that does take time, but it's perfectly possible to do it. That's the bit where we're training our body to be less sensitive to carbon dioxide and to breathe at the volume that we actually need.
Okay. Not overbreathe. And that's your video you've got on your website, is that right?
Well, that is actually, to do that, there's different aspects to it, because you're training someone to be less sensitive.
Okay. So really you need to seek out some sort of practitioner to help you along the way with that, someone like yourself.
Yeah. Or you can train, there's a book, Patrick McEwen's got a book called Sleep with Buteco. So you can train yourself with that as well.
How long do you think it takes? I suppose how long is a piece of string, but generally how long would, until you see improvements in your sleep?
It does depend on the breathing inefficiency of the individual. So if you've got someone who is not breathing that inefficiently, some people will just literally do what James Nestor does, put a piece of tape over their mouth and they feel amazing, and that can be it. If someone's mouth snoring, if you then get, you wear a product to keep your mouth closed, the mouth snoring stops, doesn't it?
Yeah,
because you've got your mouth closed.
Yeah,
what can happen then is you can then start nasal snoring, and there's we need to obviously consider then about the breathing volume. But so it depends on the individual and how inefficient they are. I would say I minimum I train someone is like an hour a week for 5 weeks, and definitely you can move, depending on how much effort they put in, you can definitely move people on quite significantly. Those say with long COVID, chronic fatigue, chronic pain, you're talking a lot longer. You have to go a lot more gently with those people who are experiencing those things. So I do a 10-week program for that. But I'd say you're retraining your body. You're consciously training your body to unconsciously breathe better 24 hours a day. And I think most of what I've read is it takes a minimum of three months probably then to train it, that it just happens naturally without unconscious thought. But you see improvements, some people can see improvements just like from the first time they get the mouth closed at night. Some people it can take a bit long, say someone who's got like long COVID, their body's really, really adapted to being so sensitive to carbon dioxide, and their autonomic nervous system is very challenge very differently. And actually sometimes they can feel a little bit worse before they feel better, because you're changing their physiology. And there has to be a trust that we have to go through that. So it just depends, really.
Yeah. I imagine that once you start doing this, you start making these improvements, that it's going to have a massive knock-on effect to so many other things, such as, anxiety, irritability, maybe also, I imagine, I hear a lot of women who have heart palpitations and breathlessness. I imagine that is a great side effect of all of this.
You're essentially, your body, it's the basic foundation of life. As you said, it is the most important function. even the best free divers in the world can only go minutes without breathing. So our body prioritizes breathing. And of course, if you're breathing inefficiently, it will keep you breathing because it's programmed by evolution to keep you breathing. But it's amazing how many you start to use the wrong muscles. If you actually alter your carbon dioxide levels, your kidney actually changes the amount of bicarbonate it passes into the urine to counteract the change that you've made in your carbon dioxide. You know, it's that amazing. It can affect literally every part of the body. One thing, anecdotally, so I'm not saying I can give you a scientific paper on this, but one of the big things that some of us as breathing practitioners have noticed is people's skin is better if we get breathing better at night. And we think it's because our skin obviously repairs itself. It's the biggest organ. It needs to completely renew itself every 2 to 3 weeks, I think. And if you're in that fight flight mode at night because you've got sleep disordered breathing, your body's not going to prioritize updating your skin, because that can be left, can't it? It wants to prioritize brain and kidney and heart, etc. And as well, you talk about palpitations. When you improve your breathing, your resting pulse rate and your blood pressure comes down. I've done no more exercise than I've done for a long time, but my resting pulse now is back to where I was at medical school when I was training 6 days a week, and my resting pulse is now 47, which gives me a huge athletic advantage when I'm trying to run. And hopefully it's going to reduce the risk of my having a heart attack and stroke. So
yes. Oh, mine's in its 40s as well. So yeah, it's good to know that. Can I just talk a little bit more about the autonomic nervous system, because I think, again, it's something which we all have ticking along nicely in the background. And again, I don't think a huge number of people have a real awareness about how important it is, because particularly in our modern day lives, it's quite often switching to and staying on the fight, flight, freeze mode rather than being in the nice sort of rest and digest mode. So I wonder whether you could just sort of talk to us a little bit more about that and how breath affects all of that.
I mean, I don't know how much your listeners know about it. They probably know a lot about it if you've been talking to them. But if I just explain it for everybody. So our body, I think, is amazing. I'm sat here and my body is literally making fine adjustments to, you know, blood pressure, pulse, breathing, pupil size, muscle contraction, bladder control, genital control, saliva in my mouth, stomach juices, you name it, it's there. And it's making those fine adjustments without any conscious control for me. I mean, I find it mind-blowing, you know, mind-blowing. And that's under the autonomic nervous system. Or people in your mind, you could say it's like the automatic nervous system. And it's in two sides. So as you said, the fight, flight, freeze one, which we call the sympathetic, or it can be that rest and digest mode, the parasympathetic. And the fight, flight, freeze response is actually wonderful. It makes us the best version of ourselves when we have a threat, a true threat. So it's wonderful. It puts our body into defense mode and ready to deal with any attack. So whether that be COVID or someone coming at me with a knife or whatever, but it makes us the best version of ourselves when it's activated infrequently. And that's the key. A modern day society, and I've seen it as a GP, particularly in the last probably 10 years, we are so much more turned on, maybe a low grade of it, but on all the time. And our body is not designed like that. So imagine your body's a car. That sympathetic nervous system is basically first gear or accelerator. It gets you out of trouble. You definitely need it. But if I drove from John O'Groats to Land's End on first gear, my car's going to break down. So that's what our human body's like. But luckily, we've got that parasympathetic. So as you say, rest and digest, or feed and breathe, or the relaxation response. And we should be in that most of the time. And when we're in that mode, we're in repair mode. Our body can repair itself. It feels safe. And that's like being, it's either brake or it's like being in fifth gear. So we want to be mainly in that mode, but we want to have flexibility. So we want that flexibility in that nervous system so that we can flip to sympathetic when we want to. So a bit like driving a car with 2 feet. So instead of accelerator and brake, we're just making fine adjustments. And there's certain medical conditions. So POTS, for example, that postural orthostatic tachycardic syndrome, essentially they lose that flexibility. So they're either move very sort of abruptly from one to the other. So most of the time, we would say we have no real control over that. There are things we can do that I'm sure you promote. So those things that help the vagus nerve. So, you know, calming music, a nice relaxed bath, yoga, being in nature, they all help us bring us into that parasympathetic. But the trouble with those sort of activities, we do them for a set period of time, not 24 hours a day. But the way we breathe actually influences that autonomic nervous system. So if we breathe like I've stubbed my toe, so, you know, I'm open mouth, I'm upper chest, I'm fast breathing, maybe irregular breathing, maybe holding my breath on after the inhale, that is telling my body there's a threat. That's telling my body that they need to be on, it needs to be on high alert, and it will stimulate that fight flight response. Whereas if I'm breathing in and out of my nose, it's slow, it's gentle, the exhale is longer than the inhale, and I'm using my diaphragm, that tells my body I'm safe. And then that's key, isn't it? Because now then, hopefully people understand that if I breathe in a slow, gentle, diaphragmatic way in and out through my nose, I'm telling my body I'm safe, I can repair myself at night. Whereas if I'm snoring, holding my breath, loud, noisy, my body thinks I'm unsafe. And actually, there's a part in our brain called the amygdala, which is has a role in fear, and it spies on our breathing center, and it tries to wake us up if it thinks we're being attacked. And that's where sleep disordered breathing comes in. So, and obviously we can manipulate it, can't we? As you say, that if we're in a certain scenario, then we want to be in that relaxation response. Well, let's get the mouth closed. Let's slow down the breathing. Let's soften the breathing. Use the diaphragm, and that will calm us down. But the key is, I think, is training your body to breathe like that 24 hours a day. And then that makes you more likely to be in the parasympathetic. And as part of the breathing training as well, we do exercises that actually flip people between the two to get that resilience in the autonomic nervous system. So it is fascinating.
I love it. And you're so right. So often we just do these activities which are so short lived, but actually, as you say, it's a 24 hour practice to try and keep ourselves in it, which is the most important thing. And it's really important as well for things like, you know, for people who are worried about perhaps increased weight gain, particularly at perimenopause. If you're in a constantly stressed state, then you're going to be producing more glucose, which is going to be putting on, you know, increasing the belly fat around the middle. So it's another kind of reason, you know, if that's you, to really think about actually how are you breathing.
Especially at night, because our body really should be at night, shouldn't it? It should go into that parasympathetic response. Those cortisol levels, which is our body's steroid levels, essentially should drop overnight because we don't need them. But those people that have sleep disordered breathing, they're still in fight-flight mode. They're still pushing out lots of steroids. So exactly what you say, it fuels weight gain, which then obviously fuels sleep disordered breathing more, because maybe you're carrying a bit more around the neck, et cetera, or on your tummy. And we actually think it interferes with the, you know, the hunger hormones and the hormone that's to do with sort of feeling full. You don't get that switch around that you should do when you're asleep if you've got sleep disordered breathing. So this is why I just think it's so crucial that, you know, if you want health and well-being as you transition through, we've got to get that breathing quiet, slow, gentle, in and out through the nose, driven by the diaphragm when you're asleep. It's just so crucial.
My goodness, so much amazing information, Louise. Thank you so much. Just to finish, I ask all my guests this, just to try and give the listeners kind of one practical, actionable step to take forward with them. What would you suggest to them today?
I would say prospectively observe your breathing over the next week, and honestly, take on board that the nose is there to be breathed in and out of 24 hours a day. And if you're not doing that, please work on it. I'll give you there's a page on my website where I've really detailed what you could do to help yourself. And if we could put that in the show notes, yeah. And then you just have a there's some real practical steps if you want to take it forward after that. But the nose is there to be used to breathe. It's a wonderful organ. Use it.
Thank you. And if anybody does want to come and have a look at your website, I will put it all in the show notes, but maybe just could tell everybody what it is and where else they can find you.
And if you just put in Dr. Louise Oliver Menopause, I think it brings it up on Google. You'll find it there. I'm on Instagram as Dr. Louise Oliver TLC and Facebook as Louise Oliver.
Fantastic. Louise, thank you so much for your time. It's been so fascinating, so interesting. And I really love the work you're doing and, you know, in helping women gain more awareness about the importance of breath, as it is an important piece of the jigsaw puzzle. It's definitely something which I am going to be talking about more to the women I come across as well. So thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you for your time.
I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. I will put all of those links which we discussed in the episode, I'll put it all into the show notes. So here are the highlights of this episode. Number one, managing perimenopause is like a jigsaw puzzle. There are various pieces in the jigsaw, such as hormones, what we eat, what we drink, how we exercise, how we manage our stress, sleep, purpose, connection with others, and how we breathe. The size of those pieces really varies according to each individual. Number two, breathing affects every part of our body, and how we breathe affects our health and well-being. Try and observe your breathing over the next week just to assess how you breathe. Number three, effective breathing is nasal breathing, so that's in and out of the nose. Quiet, soft, slow, and gentle at rest. You should notice a tiny pause after the exhale. And as you breathe, the lower ribs go out when you breathe in, and the ribs go in when you breathe out. Number four, hormonal changes as we go through perimenopause affect the way we breathe, with a steep rise in sleep disordered sleeping. So if you're noticing snoring, don't laugh it off. Take note, and you can take action to overcome this. Number five, the nose is there to be breathed in and out of 24 hours a day. It's a use it or lose it organ. If you don't use it, it actually blocks up, which forces you to continue to mouth breathe. Number six, there is no function of the mouth in breathing. Number seven, there's a natural filter in your nose. The nose filters in the air, it warms the air, it pressurizes the air, it moistens the air, making it really kind to the lungs. And it also produces nitric oxide, which sterilizes the incoming air. Number eight, to open your airways, practice placing your tongue flat on the roof of your mouth, not touching your teeth, with your lips sealed. Make sure you're not clenching your jaw and relax your face. Tag this onto an everyday activity. Maybe say in your head, tongue, to really practice doing this. Number nine, the way we breathe influences our autonomic nervous system. The key is training your body to breathe in a calm way 24 hours a day. This will help keep us in the parasympathetic mode, which is also known as the rest and digest mode. And number 10, if you want health and well-being as you transition through perimenopause, breath is an important part of it. Ensure your breathing is quiet, slow, gentle, in and out through the nose, driven by the diaphragm when you're awake and you're asleep. Thank you so, so much for listening. I appreciate your time. I know how busy you all are. And if you enjoyed this episode, do feel free to rate, subscribe, and review. As you know, it really helps get this podcast out there. Or if you feel that someone you know might really benefit from listening to this episode, why not send them an email or a text and share this episode with them? Have a wonderful, wonderful week. And as always, let me know your thoughts on this episode, if you enjoyed it or if you actually have any comments about it. Take care, and I will see you next time. Bye.